It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it turns out that financial uncertainty and not being able to count on a steady income is more challenging for America's working families than how much or how little they make. We'll find out why, and we'll ask you to share your experiences.
First, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above 22,000 on Wednesday, an all-time high, one that President Trump is taking credit for. He also predicts that the markets will continue to climb.
But when we hear that the Dow is shattering records, what exactly does that mean for the economy? And many point out that Wall Street isn't Main Street. So what are the implications here for average citizens, especially those who may not have money in the markets?
Akani Otani joins us now. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. Akani, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how big a deal is this number for the Dow Jones crossing the 22,000 threshold for the first time?
It really depends who you ask. A lot of investors and analysts will say, you know, it's just another round number. But I guess the significance is more in sort of the opportunity to reflect on, you know, what brought us here from the last 1,000-point milestone. And in that sense, I think a lot of people have noted there's been a shift in what's been driving the U.S. stock rally recently, where we went from this sort of initial reaction after the election. There was a focus on smaller domestic-focused companies, to more recently a sort of brighter outlook for the global economy and a corresponding outperformance of multinational companies here.
So in terms of what's driving it, are you also saying that it's not necessarily driven by the United States economy, but we're looking at global factors?
Right. So one interesting thing that's happened this year is that the outlook for economic growth outside of the U.S. has actually been improving, while in the U.S. itself, a lot of economists have been saying, you know, we're more likely to see a continuation of sort of slow, steady growth. So we had the IMF last month saying they think that global GDP will come up to something like 3.5% in 2017. And that's been largely stable throughout the year. But in the U.S., the IMF has actually been cutting its forecast for economic growth. Now they're seeing something like 2.1% growth for the year compared to 2.5% one year ago. So there's been a shift in sort of the drivers of economic growth over the last year or so.
And President Trump has been taking credit for the success of the Dow, and some he's been pointing out that the Dow has been up for 20% since November's presidential election. But is that fair for the president to claim success?
Is it fair? I mean, I think some people might say he might not necessarily want to do that. We crunched the data a while ago, and we found I think the president who saw the fastest 20% rise following his election in the stock market was Herbert Hoover. And back in 1928, it only took 63 days for stocks to rise 20%. And then we fell into the Great Depression. So it really, you know, things can change. The economy you inherit is not necessarily the economy that you'll finish out your term with. And so it's hard to take credit for something as massive as the stock market.
Is there something, though, to optimism in the United States about markets and investors feeling bullish about the U.S. economy, and some of that having to do with who's in the White House?
People would argue that the term that some people use on Wall Street is animal spirits, and some people were arguing after the election that we were seeing sort of a boost in sentiment, and we saw some measures of confidence among consumers and small businesses picking up after November, as some people were hoping that we were going to see tax cuts and deregulation, and perhaps that would boost profits at companies. But a lot of these so-called Trump trades, things that responded to this initial shift in sentiment, have reversed course since the start of the year. Things like the dollar, the performance of stocks of small companies and government bonds as well. So I think now a lot of the folks that we've been talking to say it's really going to be about corporate earnings and how that comes in, and also if we will continue to see global growth pick up. And that will really be more important in determining the course of the stock market.
And going back to something you said at the beginning, you said the term animal spirits. I haven't heard that before. What does that refer to?
It's just this sort of vague term for the confidence or sentiment that might be driving some of these stock market. So it's not necessarily something that you can measure, and you know, not everyone's going to agree exactly on the scale to which it might be playing a role in the stock market's performance. But in the couple months after the election, there were quite a few people arguing that some of the gains that we saw in the U.S. stock market were coming from improved sentiment.
We're talking with Akani Otani right now about the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossing the 22,000 threshold for the very first time, and what it means for the economy and also for you. And I want to ask you, Akani, is this good news for everybody? Is this good news, for example, for Main Street, for someone who doesn't have a stake in a multinational corporation? Is this for everybody, or is this for people in specific financial sectors?
Well, I think that's been the big question throughout this long stock market rally we've been observing, you know, since the financial crisis. Not everybody has participated, and if you are an individual investor and you haven't put any money into the stock market, and now you're seeing the Dow just hit 22,000, a lot of people are saying it's kind of hard to do anything about it, almost. By a variety of measures, the stock market looks expensive compared to where it was trading 10 or so years ago, and that's making it difficult for people who haven't participated in the rally so far to decide, you know, we're going to jump in. There's also sort of the aspect that after being in a bull market, seeing stocks rise for the past more than 8 years at this point, you have people who are starting to get a bit nervous and saying, you know, if the growth in the U.S. economy starts slowing down, if we suddenly see commodity prices reverse course, if we see global economic outlook actually isn't as bright as it seems like it is right now, we could see a pretty severe reversal in the stock market, which we haven't seen in a long time. So all those things make it difficult, I think, and sort of point to the fact that it's not necessarily a fantastic thing for everybody that we've hit this milestone.
And if somebody's watching and saying, hey, the stock market's looking pretty good, is now the right time to jump in? But you're saying maybe not because the prices are up. I mean, what does the average investor do if they are looking to just maybe start out?
Well, I mean, you know, we can't give any investment advice, but what we hear from portfolio managers is that it's just it's a frustrating situation for people who aren't in the market, and whether they should get in or not. I mean, it's sort of a $1 million question when you think of it in terms of how long is this stock market rally going to last. I mean, we've hit 22,000 this year. The Dow just closed at another record today. And I think all three stock major stock indexes are on course for their best year since 2013 or so at this point. But you have a lot of signs that people are pointing to that suggest maybe it's time to be a little bit more cautious. Maybe these gains are going to be given up. But, you know, of course, nobody ever knows when exactly that point will come. So it's definitely a difficult situation to be in if you're not in the market.
I want to run a comment on Facebook by you here. Jonathan on Facebook said, the Fed created hundreds of billions of new money through two rounds of quantitative easing. That money did not trickle down to Main Street, he says, where it would cause major inflation and consumer prices, but it had to go somewhere. If it went to the finance sector and the mega wealthy investors, bam, he says, huge inflation in the stock indices. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that is one of the concerns that some people are pointing to. What is going to happen when not just the Fed, but central banks around the world move away from what's been an unprecedented level of accommodative monetary policy, when they sort of move away and start raising rates again and stop some of their asset purchases, are we going to continue seeing the stock market rise, and are corporations going to be able to, I guess survive the subsequent tightening of financial conditions? So that is definitely a risk factor that some people are beginning to cite. We see the Fed moving toward more rate increases.
We're talking right now with Wall Street Journal reporter Akani Otani about the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossing 22,000 for the first time, talking about what that means for the economy.
And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think is driving the success of the market right now? If you've got money invested, how are you feeling about the record high? And if you don't have money invested, are you worried that you're missing out? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Wall Street Journal reporter Akani Otani about the Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting another all-time high yesterday and what it means for the economy and maybe for you.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you think markets will continue to rise, or are we bound to fall back soon? And who do you think deserves credit for a strong market? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a first caller now. We have Charlie on the line with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I was going to comment more about the stock market and how it affects individual states, such as like Illinois and Wisconsin. A lot of the state workers, our public service unions, have money invested in the stock market through their pensions and retirement funds. So the question would be, what would happen to states who are already burdened by a lot of debt and other financial requirements? What would happen if the stock market went down? And isn't this kind of saving them right now from other problems? Thanks so much.
Charlie, thank you. Akani, what do you say?
Yeah, we've certainly written in the last year or so about the difficulty that a lot of states have been facing with pension funds, and you've seen in the last year or so some of these pension funds actually reaching further into what many people consider to be riskier investments just to sort of keep up with the overall market. So that definitely is something that is a point of concern for some portfolio advisors. You know, what's going to happen to those pension funds if we suddenly see a pullback? You know, right now, just because the stock market is trading at all-time highs doesn't necessarily mean we'll end the year there. In fact, a lot of analysts are saying we're already, in terms of the S&P 500, roughly where a lot of them expect to end the year. So it's definitely a risky point that people are watching out for right now.
You were talking a little earlier about expansion, and one thing economists don't agree on is, you know, can the economy keep expanding forever? It seems like the answer would be no, but what is it reasonable to expect in a position like we are right now?
Yeah, so right now we are in a state that some economists would say would be late in the cycle. The U.S. was sort of considered to be leading growth and recovery in the years after the financial crisis. But in the last year or so, we've seen places like Europe, China, India posting more growth. corporate profits picking up, various measures of activity in sectors like manufacturing picking up as well, and meanwhile, sort of more lukewarm measures of economic activity in the U.S. And so that might suggest to some people that because we got a little bit of a head start, so to speak, our economic expansion would be due for contraction sooner. Of course, there's a saying, you know, that bull markets don't die of old age. So just because the U.S. is the economy has been expanding for the last several years doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to fall into recession tomorrow. But it just ends up being that the longer the stock market keeps rising, the longer we're in a state of economic expansion, the more nervous more people start getting about when we're going to see a turnaround.
Take one more quick call from Dan in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, okay. My comment today would be is that I think sometimes journalists and people who discuss financial information look at investing as being a binary event. I was a broker for 35 years. I was an options principal. And I would tell most people that investing over is essentially a lifetime event. It's incremental. It is month by month by way of a 401k. And I can show you a lot of data where if you were to buy into your 401k at the high of every month that you bought for the last 30 years, you would still have a considerable amount of wealth, certainly much more money than you ever put in. And I think talking about a Dow at 22,000, I think I really would really take, for most individuals, I'll really take a more Warren Buffett approach on this as far as investing goes, in that I would look at it as something you really don't pay that much attention to the market. You basically make your investments on an incremental base, month by month, year by year, decade by decade. And by doing that, not worrying about the market, when to get in, when to get out, you're going to have a nice net worth. And I oftentimes tell people, if you're in good high-quality funds, ETFs, you really don't need to see what the performance is. You go over the long haul historically.
And we got to leave it there, Dan. We're out of time. Dan got the last word. Connie, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Connie Otani, reporter for The Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. She's with us there to talk about the Dow hitting a new high and looking at what that might have to say about where the American economy is today.
A $650 million bridge linking western Wisconsin with the Twin Cities opened to the public this week. As Rich Kramer reports, the completion of the mile-long St. Croix crossing caps a decades-long battle between the river's environmental legacy and the need for better infrastructure in one of the fastest-growing parts of the state.
One, two, three.
It's opening day for this towering span of concrete spires draped with thick white cables. On a stage in the middle of the eastbound lanes, a group of strange political bedfellows cut a red ribbon celebrating the bridge's completion. Republicans Governor Scott Walker and Congressman Sean Duffy were seated next to Democrats Congressman Ron Kind and Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton. Walker called it a striking example of the bipartisan support for a link connecting St. Croix County with a straight line shot into the Twin Cities.
This really is cooperation. This is cooperation between federal government, state government, local government, between the private sector and the public sector, between Minnesota and Wisconsin.
The crossing has five concrete piers with cables holding a roadway 110 feet over the St. Croix River. It replaces a cast iron two-lane lift bridge built in 1931, often in disrepair. Some local commuters would say the Depression-era structure was in such bad shape they'd unbuckle seatbelts and roll down windows to swim out in case of collapse. It took supporters more than 20 years to get the St. Croix crossing. Many at the ceremony gave credit to a New Richmond banker named John Soderberg for lobbying endlessly for it.
I started over in Wisconsin going up and down and saying that we need to do something about this bridge. And at that time, Minnesota had not said anything. And then after a meeting in 1992, they said, can we join you? And I said, yes, the more the merrier. And there's going to be a lot of work with it.
That proved to be an understatement. The St. Croix is federally protected under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, so when plans for a replacement bridge came out in 1995, Minnesota's North Star chapter of the Sierra Club sued to block it. Then a mediator was brought in and a group of 28 stakeholders began hashing out differences. But Minnesota Sierra Club director Margaret Levin says their smaller, more environmentally friendly bridge designs were dismissed.
We felt that those options were never really taken seriously. And so we saw through the process the continued proposal for a large highway expansion, which is how we view the St. Croix crossing.
The group sued again in 2007, putting the St. Croix crossing on ice once more. Frustrated, supporters went for a long shot. If they could get a congressional exemption, bridge construction could begin. After intense lobbying, the St. Croix crossing exemption won unanimous approval in the Senate, and in February 2012, Republican Congressman Sean Duffy made the case to the U.S. House.
There is no appropriations aspect. There's no budgetary authority. All we're doing is deeming this bridge consistent with the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act.
The House voted overwhelmingly for the project, and President Barack Obama gave his signature days later. By comparison, the 5 years of construction seemed like a flash in the pan. From the shores, residents eagerly awaited its opening, as did building contractors in Wisconsin. Eric Allen of New Richmond says the anticipation of a new bridge and an improving economy have driven home building in the city.
Compared to a couple years ago, it's probably 10 times the amount, you know, new construction.
8 hours after the St. Croix crossing was dedicated, it opened to traffic. An air of excitement hung over thousands of cars creeping along the well-lit deck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. John Soderberg was asked what he'll do with his time now after spending 20 years pushing for the bridge.
I don't know. If I said I wanted a glass of brandy, that'd be all right, wouldn't it?
That would be all right.
Okay.
Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Many of us, at one point in our lives or another, have had to pay a bill late, bounced a check, or lost sleep worrying about making ends meet. And that stress is compounded when we're surrounded by messages that we should be saving for retirement, that our kids' college fund should be started when they're born, if not before, and that saving for long-term goals is the responsible way to manage money.
A new book looks in detail at how America's working families are getting by. And a lot of the research flies in the face of what conventional wisdom says about earning, spending, and saving.
Jonathan Mordick is an economist at New York University. He writes about the financial lives of low-income families and how they connect to poverty and inequality. He's also the executive director of the Financial Access Initiative at NYU. His most recent book, written with Rachel Schneider, is The Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. Let's lay out the framework of your research. Whose experiences were you looking at?
We aim to look at a broad cross-section from America, trying to understand what's going on with kind of typical families. So the key to what we did was to step away from the reams of official government statistics we have, which give a big snapshot of how we're doing in America. And we aimed instead to get to know a smaller group of families who did something pretty incredible, which was to let Rachel and me and our research team get to know everything about what the families were doing over an entire year. And so we tracked everyone's income, spending, saving, borrowing, things they shared with neighbors, everything they did over a full year. Getting to know families in different parts of the U.S., not the poorest, not the richest, but kind of the broad middle of the economy today.
And if I remember correctly, Jonathan, that one of the qualifications for being part of this study was that at least one person in the family had to be working.
Everybody had at least one working member, exactly. So we were looking for families who are trying to move ahead. Like so many families today, most of them have jobs of some kind, and we wanted to know what those jobs look like and why families are having a hard time, achieving that American dream and achieving those savings and getting out of debt. And the only way we could figure out to really understand it was to spend a lot of time with the families and track their finances really closely and come up with a new story.
And how many people did you end up following during the course of that year?
We tracked 235 families, which was an awful lot given how intense this was. It's a very small number relative to, you know, the population of America or the kind of data sets that I, as an economist, usually use. But the data was very intense. I mean, we collected tens of thousands of data points for each household, really every transaction the families were making. And we were really trying to find typical experiences. So we did include lots of different kinds of people from different communities, Black families, white, ethnic communities of various sorts, single people, large families, small families, really across the board, trying to look at different kinds of experiences and find some common threads.
I think many of us assume that people who are struggling financially are having a hard time because they just don't make enough money or aren't good at managing the money they earn. But what you and your team of researchers found is really much more nuanced than that. Can you tell us kind of what those themes were?
Yeah, it is more nuanced. But part of the backdrop is that wages have not been rising, right? And I'm sure a lot of listeners, you know, understand that and see that in their community. So part of it is that wages haven't been rising, but there's another issue, which is instability, that a lot of jobs today are not stable, not consistent. There's a national survey, this isn't our data, but a national survey asked Americans whether they have consistent and predictable income and expenses throughout the year, and only about half said they did. So you've got a big chunk of America that's feeling vulnerable to ups and downs and having a hard time planning and budgeting and doing all the basic things, you know, that we assume are building blocks of a good financial life.
And so, is that a change from past generations or past decades, maybe?
I think we've always had some instability. I think the difference now is that the amount of slack that households have to buffer themselves has gone down. And you combine that lack of slack with the instability, and it's a recipe for stress, anxiety, and really difficulty investing in the future. So as, just to give you a sense of how much instability we saw in our data, it was really surprising. You know, we were tracking the families month by month, and we counted months in which their incomes were either 25% above average or 25% below average. So we call these spikes and dips, these big differences from the averages. And we found on average that households had 5 months out of the year in which their income was either spiking or dipping. So that means, you know, almost half the year they were at a level that was, you know, not consistent at all. I mean, these are big deviations. Mm-hmm. And that was really the building block of what we were seeing.
We're talking with Jonathan Morduch right now. He's an economist at New York University. And we're discussing his new book, which is titled The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Jonathan, one of the great things about your book is that you have so many stories that really illustrate these points. Can you tell us about one of the people that you followed where these spikes and dips were something that they were dealing with on a very constant basis?
So one of the families we got to know lives in Ohio, and they it's a couple. They have four children. Becky and Jeremy is what we call them. We change names to preserve confidentiality. But Becky and Jeremy are living at a decent wage, you know, for their family in Ohio. They're certainly above the poverty line. And yet what we found was that Jeremy, who's a truck mechanic, he fixes those big rigs that, you know, deliver all the goods and products that we depend on. Jeremy fixes those trucks. And it turns out that Jeremy's income is high in the winter and the summer because that's when weather is terrible, either way too hot or way too cold, and the trucks are suffering. And Jeremy works on commission, and so his biggest paychecks are in those seasons. Spring and fall comes, they're really, you know, the paychecks really shrink. And so Jeremy represents something we saw again and again and again, which is families that have steady jobs, but not steady incomes. So just listening to the previous segment and Secretary Perdue's in Wisconsin this week, today, and talking about creating jobs. But what we saw was that lots of families have jobs. Most people have jobs. Unemployment rate is actually pretty low right now. It's about 4.3% nationally. People have jobs for the most part, but those jobs are much lower quality in terms of predictability and stability than they used to be.
And what I found really interesting was kind of an aha moment for me reading the book was that you point out that if you look at, for instance, that family's income over the course of a year, and you look at their spending over the course of the year, you think, well, why are they having a hard time? That, you know, they should be making it, but it's that cash flow, when the cash is there and when the cash is not, versus those regular expenses that have to be paid.
Yeah, exactly. So Becky and Jeremy, they've got to pay for their, you know, their utility bills, their house bill, their car bills every month, whether or not, you know, their income is high or low. And that's really the challenge of so many families. We've got income going up and down, expenses going up and down, and trying to piece it together so that the equation works is really, really hard. So there was a national survey that asked whether the respondents could come up with $400 in a hurry, if there's some emergency, say your car breaks down. And the latest survey showed that only about 44% of respondents said they could come up with $400 without having to borrow it or sell something. That's part of this equation that makes it really hard when your income's going up and down and your expenses are volatile also.
We're talking with Jonathan Morduch right now. He's an economist at New York University, and we're discussing his most recent book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty.
And we hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a hard time making ends meet? Is it just because of how much you make, or does your income vary? Does it fluctuate from paycheck to paycheck, or maybe season to season? Are you able to save for short-term goals, but maybe not those a little farther out? And what techniques do you use to get by? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Jonathan Morduch about how working families manage their money when income goes up and down from month to month. He's the co-author of a new book called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you know exactly how much you'll make on every paycheck, or does it vary week to week or month to month? How do you manage to pay your bills on time if your income isn't consistent? Or have you gotten behind because of the timing of your spending and earning? And what about saving? If you're able to put money away, is it for short-term or long-term needs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jonathan, I really found your book fascinating because it gives us so much insight into the challenges working families in America are facing. And one of the things that really struck me was how creative people are in trying to make ends meet. Can you give us an example or two of those really interesting workarounds or work-throughs?
One woman I really got to know well is named Janice, and she is a car dealer in Mississippi. She works at a casino. And if you're a casino worker, it turns out that you do well when in the middle of the summer when lots of folks are at the casino, but come winter and the fall, fewer people come. So Janice works really hard to save up during the summer, and then she can have money in the winter. So Janice does some interesting things. She needs some discipline to save that money, and she opened a savings account about an hour south in a credit union. And the credit union had really lousy hours, and she said, hey, that works for me. And she went one step further. She cut up the ATM cards that the credit union gave her. And that made it so that she knew she'd have to drive an hour south to get money from her savings account when she needed it. And that gave her both the structure of locking up the money in an inconvenient place, but also, you know, the flexibility for the times when she'd say she really, really needed the money. So when those really, really need moments came, she would get in the car and she would drive down there. So the banks, it turned out, in her hometown were just too flexible and too convenient, and she had to find something that was just the right level of not convenient.
Let's take a call now. Julie in Fond du Lac is up first. Hi, Julie.
Hello. Hi, this is Julie.
Yeah.
I think that's quite an interesting topic because I feel like our family is different than the other families around us. My husband's a commercial fisherman in Alaska during the summer and a taxidermist, self-employed in the winter. So he can't get insurance because the fishing is so dangerous. So I have to cover my family for insurance. And what he makes in the summer, we have to spread through the whole year because then we have to pay taxes in the end, self-employment tax and taxes on all of his money. So it's really hard to, we've never come up with a good system besides not spending. So it's...
Do you find yourself getting behind on bills, Julie?
No, but no, we're able to keep up with bills. We keep up, but we don't spend anything. We're basically ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's tough. We don't know what's going to happen in the spring. The day-to-day things are fine, but, you know, in a few months, you know, we don't know what taxes we're going to pay until it comes tax time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for that call, Julie. And Jonathan, does that echo some of the things that you heard from the people that you were working with?
Yeah, in lots of ways. I mean, what Julie describes is an example of a family that has, you know, a decent annual income, but it's not about the annual income. The concerns are, you know, when the money's coming and when the expenses are coming. And that just changes the story once you see that that timing really matters. And it's all about having the right money at the right time, even if you've got enough money over the year in total.
And Jonathan, I remember from your book that one of the people that you worked with couldn't figure out why she was getting behind because, again, looking at the I make X amount of money in a month and my expenses are Y, why am I not being able to cover it? And she realized it was when those bills were hitting. So she actually went to some of the companies and said, hey, you know, can I move my car payment from the 5th to the 20th and spread it out a little differently? And that really worked for her.
Yeah, she was really proactive. She was really a very thoughtful young woman. And you can do that some of the time. That was really a nice step. She managed to talk to her the credit card companies. You know, the situation that Julie's in, you can't get the, you know, the U.S. government to rearrange tax time to something more convenient for you. They charge you taxes whenever they want to. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle for lots of families.
Julie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Maurice in Madison. Hi, Maurice.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest favors anything beyond joining a credit union far away, such as the guaranteed annual income that was favored by conservative economist Milton Friedman.
Thanks for that call. And Jonathan, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different things. So what Janice did with that credit union was just something that she figured out as a workaround. And other folks do other things to try to save money, you know, for the short term and smooth things out. It would be great to see, you know, other steps that are more structural and more fundamental. Guaranteed basic income that Milton Friedman and lots of people are very interested in these days. Certainly could do the same thing. It guarantees steadiness and stability and could really simplify people's lives. I'm not betting on that being implemented anytime soon, but I do think there are some steps that the government could take, you know, sooner rather than later. You know, for example, there's been proposed legislation to guarantee workers that in terms of their hourly schedules, so these would be hourly workers, that they have enough lead time so they can predict their hours in a given month and then can, you know, can count on that. So there are some attempts to try to smooth things out through legislation, and certainly collective action of various kinds also, you know, can help give workers a little bit more bargaining power so that they can, you know, negotiate not just for higher wages, but also more stable wages.
Thanks for that call, Maurice. And Jonathan, I was also really interested in what you found out about efforts to save money. We hear so much about how we need to save for longer term goals like retirement, and we also get chided as a nation for not saving enough. But you learned that people that you were working with in this study were saving, but in a very different way than is kind of the conventional wisdom. How are these people that were living with financial uncertainty using saving?
Yeah, it's interesting. We often think of saving as only long-term saving. So like you're saying, those retirement accounts or the college 529s or, you know, other investments that are going to help you down the road. What we saw is households saving and filling up their savings accounts, but doing it for short-term needs because the ups and downs require that 6 months from now, a year from now, you're going to need some extra money. So it's totally prudent, it's totally smart, but that money doesn't end up accumulating for the long term. We ask people how long the money in their savings accounts is going to last. About two-thirds said within a year. So we often come to exactly the wrong conclusion when we say people haven't saved for the long term, so they must be, you know, living, overspending and just subject to temptation and unable to discipline themselves. We found the opposite. We found people working really hard to save, having an incredible amount of discipline, but saving for the short term, not for the long term. So it was a very different story and a very different sort of policy frame to start thinking about how to help people also save for those long-term important goals.
And you also said, Jonathan, that they were saving for those shorter, medium-term goals, depleting their savings, and then turning around and immediately starting saving for the next thing.
Yeah, it's a really active and difficult way of saving. That's what one has to do when your income's going up and down. And we don't, banks haven't designed products and government hasn't designed policies in ways that really help households with that kind of active saving. We really need a new conversation around helping people save, you know, given the kinds of savings issues that they're really facing.
Let's take a really quick call from Lisa in Stevens Point. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was just saying, I work two jobs, but they're both minimum wage, and I'm not making ends meet, but I mean, I am, but I'm struggling.
And thanks for that call, Lisa. And one of the things that you talk about, Jonathan, is that, you know, people are working really hard. And even if they're kind of making ends meet, like Lisa said she is now, there's always that threat that something's going to spike and throw them way back.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, Lisa's a great example. Thanks for the call and the comment. A lot of people we saw are working more than one job, and partly because they need more income, partly they're trying to smooth out some of the ups and downs in, you know, their first job, so they take a second job to provide a little bit more stability. So Americans that we got to know are working really hard. They're focused on the future. They're trying to do better, but the short term is often undermining the long term.
And we'll leave it there. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. Jonathan Morduck is an economist at New York University. He's the co-author of a new book titled The Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. If you are looking to take a break from healthy eating, the State Fair can help you out. This year, there are 65 new items, along with cream puffs and corn dogs and lots of other stuff on sticks.
One that caught my eye, but probably not anything I would actually eat, cricket chips or cricket nachos. Now, generally speaking, I am a fan of nachos. You add the word cricket and I think
See,
I'm out.
I'd be all over the crickets.
Have you eaten bugs before?
I have, yeah.
Okay, so this is something you're used
ranch,
to. You probably eat them
seasoning.
Every day for lunch.
No, I don't. But, you know, they're gluten-free and high protein.
Yeah,
can't
this
go
is
wrong.
True.
This also actually sounds very good. Handmade bacon ravioli stuffed with homemade bacon bourbon jam.
And this one's probably a winner for sweet tooth, Chocomela nachos. Again, with the word nacho, so I'm in on that. Cinnamon sugar tortilla chips topped with salted caramel gelato, milk chocolate gelato, whipped cream, sweet chocolate coating, salty peanut sauce, and peanut pieces.
Wow.
That's a really long dessert.
That
sounds
lot.
Pretty good.
There are all kinds of things. The State Fair runs August 3rd through the 13th. And actually, tomorrow on Food Friday, we're going to talk about how to make fair food at home.
It sounds tasty.
And scary and dangerous.
All those things and more. Well, we'll cover all that. Let us know if you like State Fair food. And tune in tomorrow on Food Friday. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.